Hello there and welcome into another edition of The Intersection, featuring conversation highlights on a variety of topics, including news, information, and lifestyles approached from a Christian worldview perspective. This podcast is being released the weekend of September 11th, and I have some content from two guests that offer some perspective on two different events relative to this day. First up, it's Joe Savage of Projects That Matter, who wrote a book in response to the 9/11 attacks as a means of addressing our need for God related to a number of issues in our country. Then, in association with National Grandparents Day this year on September 11th, it's Josh Mulvihill of the Legacy Coalition, as he offered some insight about the biblical role of grandparents and also previewed an upcoming summit in Texas in November. The second Sunday of September is National Grandparents Day. Plus, Luke Smallbone of For King and Country, describing the concept of a new book that he and his brother Joel have written, and a new movie in which they're both involved, highlighting the worth of a woman and how men can underscore that value. And on this edition of The Intersection, former college football star Inky Johnson visited with me recently in advance of a visit to Montgomery, Alabama. You see, 10 years ago, the NFL prospect had a life-threatening and life-changing injury occur that God used for his purposes. Some comments ahead. Also coming up, part of a phone conversation with Nick Cassidy while he was in my area, speaking in Eclectic, Alabama. He is pastor of a church in Ireland, and he outlined some concepts related to the New Covenant. Finally, as we continue to share awareness of the situation involving the Louisiana flooding and its effects, you'll be hearing from Gary LeBlanc of Mercy Chefs, which provides quality meals for victims of disaster and conflict. This is The Intersection, a production of The Meeting House. I'm Bob Crittenden. Joe Savage is president of Projects That Matter and author of a book called We Forgot, The Seven Unlearned Lessons of 9/11. Inspired by a trip to New York City a few years ago, he highlights events surrounding a church close to the former World Trade Center site and provides some words of challenge to our country to surrender to God in a number of vital areas. Here now is Joe Savage.
Yeah, I was in New York just on a visit, you know, seeing all the sites and stumbled into this church called St. Paul's Chapel. And when I got there, I was absolutely amazed at what I learned, which put me on a path of research. And standing there that day, in that small little church that sits across from what was the World Trade Center towers, I wrote the outline of a book and then came back, quickly wrote it and produced it, and it's out and has been out for a number of years now, available to people. But it's the whole idea of this of the book is, it's called We Forgot, the Unlearned Lessons of 9/11, and it's goes to, you know, what we've forgotten as a country, what we've forgotten as a Congress, what we've forgotten as a president, what we've forgotten from citizens of faith or Christians or what have you. But the story is so fascinating, Bob. George Washington, of course, our first president, was inaugurated in New York City, there on Wall Street. And Congress was already in place, and so they set the agenda for the day. And when he came in, the church bells rang, and they had everyone gather for prayer at 12 o'clock. Then George Washington was inaugurated there at what was the Capitol of the United States for a short season. And Congress decided, in fact, it's one of the first that upon completion of the inauguration, Washington and the vice president and all members of Congress would go to St. Paul's Chapel for a divine service. And so they marched down Wall Street, took a right there on Broadway, and went into St. Paul's Chapel and had a time of prayer and calling out to God on behalf of their new president. And that's where George Washington worshiped the first year or so of his presidency. And in that very church, St. Paul's Chapel, though all the buildings around the World Trade Center towers, when the day the terrorists hit, every building was damaged, windows blown out, awnings ripped off, of course, substantial damages we've all seen. But there was one building that didn't have damage, not even a window blown out, and that was St. Paul's Chapel, the place where George Washington and Congress met for his first day of having prayer on the job. And I just find that fascinating, and that's in essence what the story is about.
What does that survival of that church tell us, or what message does it send to us here 15 years after 9/11?
Well, I think it's the same message as 15 years ago and the same message 150 years ago or in 1776 when we declared our independence as a nation. And that is where Jesus himself said, you know, if you're going to build a house on sand, when the winds blow and the waters rise, it's going to fall. But if you build your house on a rock, it's going to stand. And the message for us as a nation, and I think that we see in that story of St. Paul's Chapel, is that was the only building that didn't receive damage on 9/11, 15 years ago. And it's the place of prayer. It's the bedrock. It's what our country was founded upon. And certainly not as a Christian nation, but founded upon Christian principles. And so that is the rock. Everything else is shifting sand. And I think that it was also a reminder to us that as a country, the more secularized we become and the more that we continue to erode Christian values in society, the more that we move over to building our country upon sand. And when those storms rise and the waters rise, just like we have seen here and is going to increasingly see, our country will not survive. And that's just a flat out fact. I'm not saying the country goes away, but certainly our freedoms go away. And that's why George Washington and members of Congress even knelt in that church on that day of George Washington's inauguration, was to call upon God as our hope, as our answer, as our provider, as our rock. And that's what Washington did. Every Sunday, as he would call upon God's wisdom in his own life. And here it is, you know, this many years later, and when we don't allow prayer even in our so many public venues, and it's a tragedy and it's a shame because we've lost our way somewhere along the line. And 9/11 should have served as a wake-up call, and it was a temporary emotional patriotism that we find ourselves in 15 years later, worse shape than we were 15 years ago.
Joe Savage here on The Intersection. You can find him on Facebook or learn more about Emmanuel House, with which he's involved, at ehouseforgirls.org. You can obtain a copy of the book by emailing joecsavage@gmail.com. Well, The Intersection continues now with Josh Mulvihill, who serves as pastor to children and families at Grace Church in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, and who is affiliated with the Legacy Coalition, which was launched in association with Awana. In our recent conversation, he addressed the role of grandparents from a biblical perspective and previewed the Legacy Grandparenting Summit in Frisco, Texas, November 15th through 17th. From that conversation, this is Josh Mulvihill.
Well, there's a biblical role that God's given that I don't think has been recognized well, both by churches and certainly not by culture. And God's laid out as clearly in Scripture the role of grandparents with the family as he has parents, fathers, mothers. And it's a role that no one else can fill, and it's an important role. And so when we understand what that role is, hopefully that helps grandparents step in and be intentional in passing on faith to grandkids. I think that was the first. I think second is just the void that's present both in churches on this subject and in resources for grandparents. It really has been a topic that's been almost avoided entirely. And there's about 30 million Christian grandparents. That's a rough estimate. 30 million Christian grandparents in America, and they need a vision and they need some resources, and their grandkids, I'd say their grandkids need them. We are living in a culture where there are a lot of voices for kids, and having another adult that loves Jesus on their side is huge.
Mm. There are some resources. In fact, you've been involved in the development of some resources that are going to be made available here in the very near future. There's also the Legacy Grandparenting Summit that is coming up in November in Texas. So let's talk about the purpose, as you see it, for the Legacy Coalition.
Yeah, in summary, it's to help grandparents pass faith on to grandkids. It's intentional Christ-centered grandparenting, and we see some grandparents need a vision for what that is. Others already have that and just need some resources for their specific scenario, and we're trying to accomplish that with the coalition. We recognize that there are a lot of individuals that have created and written things, and we're trying to gather those, and we're also trying to create where there are holes. And so if you're a grandparent and are looking for help, I think the Legacy Coalition could provide hopefully some of what is needed in your world. You know, whether that's I'm a long-distance grandparent and I'm trying to figure out how to do this from a distance, or I've got a grandchild with a disability. I've got an adult child that is divorced, and I'm stepping into kind of more of a parenting role. There, all these scenarios are in need of resources, and some of them are being developed as we speak, and we will be seeing a wonderful wave of resources coming out this fall, and hopefully that's just the tip of the iceberg, a lot of what is to come.
And the Legacy Coalition, with which you're affiliated, is sponsoring a Legacy Grandparenting Summit. It's going to be held in Frisco, Texas, coming up November 15th through 17th. And tell me about how the Legacy Coalition developed this idea of putting together this sort of summit.
Well, we want to encourage pastors to recognize the importance of grandparents. Grandparents are the second greatest influence in the life of kids, only to parents. And so we felt like this would be a good way to reach pastors, and we wanted to do that with individuals that are respected and listened to in the evangelical Christian community, and so that's why we ended up going the route that we did with the conference.
Josh Mulvihill here on The Intersection. Learn more by going to the website legacycoalition.com. Well, the Intersection podcast continues now with Luke Smallbone. He and his brother Joel are the co-founders of the band For King and Country. In our recent conversation, he discussed the concept of the book that he and Joel have written together called Priceless, She's Worth Fighting For, as well as the movie Priceless, of which Luke is an executive producer and Joel is the lead actor. From that conversation, this is Luke Smallbone.
This is kind of a year of priceless. One of the things that we've talked about at the beginning of our career is we say to women, hey, culture says for you to talk, dress, and act like you're cheap. But we believe that there's God who says that you're priceless. And then we say to men, hey, guys, it's time for us to step up and stand out in relationships in this world and be people of that are treating the opposite sex with respect and honor. And so that message had become such a big deal that about 2 years ago, we thought to ourselves, hey, what if we were to turn this into a film? And our older brother Ben is a filmmaker. And then obviously we've got this book.
Of course, when you say based on a true story, that could mean any number of things. So talk about the true story here.
So there was a documentary that my brother Ben worked on about 8 years ago. And there was an ex-crime scene dude that had kind of been in the ring of doing all sorts of terrible, you know, things and in some very, very negative behavior. And Jesus just radically changed his life. And so he ended up kind of turning on all that was in his life and kind of using the system against each other and kind of was able to get into some nooks and crannies because at one point he was the one that was designing all these kind of evil plots. And so my brother Ben watched this documentary that he was editing, and this guy gets up there. He's got a blowed out face, and if he had a name, it was a fake name because this guy was a wanted, hated man by these crime organizations. And he was just so inspired by what he had done. You know, obviously somebody who was in this world saying, "Hey, you know what? I'm no longer the same man that I was. So the mistakes that I've made, I'm going to go and do my best to redo. I'm going to try and correct what I've done wrong." And really that was the basis. That story was the basis of what has ended up being this book, end up being this movie.
So you've taken this guy as really the foundational character for the novel and, of course, the forthcoming film as well. Tell me about James Stevens and his, as we might say, lot in life as people discover him and meet him in this novel and in the film.
Yeah. So James Stevens is a kind of a down and out character in the film. The cool thing about the book is the book actually has about five or six chapters before anything starts in the film. And so you actually get to know James a little bit before in the book, what he was when his life was kind of still held together. But in the movie, we find this dude, James, who's a down and out character, and he is trying to get his life back together. He's lost his wife to a tragic accident. through the mourning process. He's not able to keep a job, so therefore Child Protective Services ends up taking his daughter because he can't afford to take care of her anymore. He's kind of neglected her. And so he takes a transportation job, kind of a no-questions-asked, hey, just take this box truck from point A to point B. But the clause is here, you got to do it straight through. And the other thing is you can't open the padlock on the back. And so obviously he knows it's something a little shady, but he's getting paid really well to do it. And he feels like this is his opportunity to kind of redirect his life. He ends up falling asleep at the wheel, running off the road. And then he realizes that it's not what he's carrying in the back, it's who. And there's two sisters in the back of the truck. And the rest of the story is kind of following their journey and how those three characters kind of interact and how the film ends.
There's an integration of human trafficking in this book. Tell me why that was important to include in the novel.
The foundation of what we're talking about is a woman's worth. And this film is essentially about that. It's about what a woman is worth today. And then what we were thinking to ourselves is, what if a woman is priceless and a soul is priceless, what's the opposite of somebody that is priceless? It's that somebody actually has a price, that you can be bought. And so the human trafficking element and just the slavery aspect of the film is really to illustrate a point that, yes, though a man tries to say that money is king, we believe and we try and we show this in our film that a soul and a life is priceless. And we want everybody. I was just at a viewing the other day, and a little girl came up to me, and she had the necklace that we sell at our shows and these bracelets that we sell at our shows that we've sold tons and tons and tons of them. And she said, when I bought these things and I wore these things, I felt to myself, okay, I think I'm priceless. And after watching the film, I know I am. And that's really our goal with this film.
Luke Smallbone here on The Intersection. You can learn more about the band by going to forkingandcountry.com. Learn more about the book at pricelessthebook.com. And for information on the movie, go to pricelessthemovie.com. Well, this is the Intersection Podcast. It's a weekly production of The Meeting House. Learn more at meetinghouseonline.info. Through that website, you can get connected to the download center marked Meeting House On Demand. Also, you can subscribe to the Intersection Podcast and have it delivered to your podcast receiving software, including iTunes, on a weekly basis. Two blogs are accessible. One is The Front Room, with devotional thoughts and commentary from The Meeting House. The other is The Three, with three stories of relevance to the Christian community. And you can follow me on Twitter and access the Meeting House Facebook page. You can also get connected to video content. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. Well, joining me recently was motivational speaker and former college football star Inky Johnson, who discussed how God used an injury to shape his life, and he shared some of the content that he relates to audiences. Prior to his speaking in my area in Montgomery, Alabama, here now, some conversation material from Inky Johnson.
I'm so thankful for, you know, September 9th, 2006, fourth quarter against the Air Force, a little bit over 2 minutes left in the game. And at the time, I was a projected first-round draft pick. So I was supposed to play that season out, then declare for the NFL draft. And I went to make a tackle fourth quarter of that game, and just a routine tackle. And I found myself in the emergency room. You know, that night, fighting for my life, I had busted an artery in my chest. I was bleeding internally. Had to take the main vein out of my left leg, plug it into my chest in order to save my life. And I had to go through more surgery because I had real bad nerve damage in my brachial plexus, which is the nerve roots that go from your spine and controls your shoulder, your arm, and your hand. And so now I was in a situation where my football career ended abruptly, and I had a paralyzed right arm and hand. And so the only thing I knew was that I wasn't giving up. I wasn't going to quit. I wasn't going to make excuses. And just through the plan of pressing forward, you know, God has manifested his plan. I never planned to speak. I never planned to do any of the things that I'm doing now. And God kind of revealed that through his plan for my life. And I'm so thankful. And I'm so grateful. What many people considered to be a tragedy that night, it has turned out to be a blessing. You know, always tell people things don't happen to you. They happen for you. Without that injury, without that situation, who's to say that I will be the man that I am today? Who's to say that I will be the father, the husband that I am today? I've learned a lot, you know, as a result of that injury. It fortified my faith. You know, it put me in situations where I was really tested, you know, to see if I was true to what I said I was true to. And I'm just thankful that God had an incredible plan for my life.
At the time of your injury, and as you mentioned, this was a life-threatening injury, and God spared your life. Mm-hmm. God took your life and took it in a new course. How would you appraise your spiritual condition prior to that night?
It's interesting because, you know, my whole life I've been a Christian. I was raised in the church. In spite of, you know, my home life and the situation that I was coming up in, I was always raised in the church. And a year and a half prior to that, when I got to the university, we had a chaplain, a guy by the name of James Mitchell. And so he started a discipleship group with me and some of my roommates. And so I had been getting discipled, you know, leading up to my injury. I had been getting discipled a year and a half, 2 years strong, to where we would meet before workouts. We would dig into the word. We would challenge each other. You know, we would go to FCA. We would go to discipleship. We would go to church. And so when my injury happened, I look back at it. Now, when I was in a situation, I didn't do it like this. But when I look back at it, I said, man, God was preparing me all along for my injury to happen. I was getting discipled from the point I hit campus up until my injury. And so I was getting poured into strong by mentors, by teammates. We were challenging each other. And so when my injury happened, my perspective was somewhat different. You know, now I was reverting back to 8:28 in Romans. Now I was reverting back to Jeremiah 29:11. Now I was reverting back to James chapter 1. It was as if God had already instilled all of these things in me. So when I hit the storm, I had something to pull from. And it shaped my perspective. And so it's pretty neat to look back on that preparation period before I hit the test.
Well, that's something. I know we can look back and see how God was preparing us, but sometimes before we encounter adversity, we don't recognize what God is doing in our lives. And what in many cases he is doing is preparing us for the next step. The next thing might happen. It may be something that is adverse, something that he desires to use for our good and for his glory. But it's important that we recognize that the adversity that we might face down the road, it's important that we're being prepared even now.
Absolutely. You know, I firmly believe, you know, God prepares us for the test before we face it, meaning God has equipped us to be victorious before, you know, we go into the trial, the opposition, the challenges, or, you know, the adversity. You know, when I look back at the story of David and Goliath, you know, I look back and I think back to when his father told him to tend to the flock of sheep and take his brother's food. And then he met the beast, and the beast had David's sheep in his mouth, and David took his sheep out and he slayed the beast. And so when the time came for David to fight Goliath, I have to believe somewhere in the back of David's mind, he thought to himself, man, I just faced a beast. I just defeated a beast. And now I got this giant Goliath, but I just defeated a beast. God made me defeat a beast. And so surely I can get through Goliath. And sometimes I think in our lives, we just forget what God has brought us through and where God has brought us from. He's prepared us all along. So when we hit the adversity, he's equipped us to be victorious.
Inky Johnson here on The Intersection. His book is entitled Inky, An Amazing Story of Faith and Perseverance. You can learn more by going to the website inkyjohnson.com. Well, this is The Intersection Podcast with Nick Cassidy, founding pastor of Cork Church in Cork City, Ireland. In our recent conversation, he discussed the concept of the new covenant, a topic that he was covering at a series of meetings in my area recently. Here now from that conversation is Nick Cassidy.
Well, the new covenant is the New Testament, of course, and it's hard to find other language that can maybe diminish any sense of fear when people hear this, because some people think that you're coming out with a new teaching, that you know, for the last 100 years of evangelicalism, everybody has been going up the left, and all of a sudden people are finding something new. So there's nothing new in this. This is just the New Testament. But it's actually going back to a fundamental understanding of how the New Covenant differs from the Old Covenant. Now, in a brief minute, if you permit me, every covenant before the New Covenant was a covenant that God made with men. And it was a relationship where God put obligations upon man, i.e. the Old Covenant with Ten Commandments. If you keep these Ten Commandments, I'll be your God. I'll give you rain in the time of the latter rain. I will protect you against your enemies, etc., etc. And so every covenant we see in the Old Testament is God making a covenant with man. But the New Covenant is diametrically different, because every covenant that man ever made with God, men broke it and failed. And that's the test of history. So the the new covenant would have to be something superior to the old covenant. And in the new covenant, we mine out from the scriptures that God doesn't make a covenant with men, he makes a covenant with Christ. And when people see that from the scriptures, immediately it becomes good news, because now all the obligations of righteousness are not placed upon us, they're placed upon Christ. And so we look into that in the scriptures, and we examine, first of all, how we arrived that the covenant is made between God the Father and God the Son, and then what are the ramifications of that. And the normal ramifications are that it gives such confidence to the believer that their faith can rise, and they begin to see a greater outworking of the true gospel power in their life, rather than thinking that somehow they're on this spiritual treadmill, which most Christians do. They end up in a spiritual treadmill of, do I read enough? Have I prayed enough? Have I given enough money? Have I done enough? Is God happy with me today? And many of your listeners live like that. They live. And actually, what David Wilkerson said to me, he said, I was preaching a gospel that I couldn't even live myself. He told me the story of his own mother, who was a holiness Pentecostal, and how she, even on her deathbed, was terrified to die in case there was something unattended or, you know, and that all stems from a fear that stems from not understanding our position of who we are in Jesus Christ. And I believe there's such a test coming to the church that unless the men and women are rightly positioned on the foundation, they will be driven by fear and they will be, you know, lacking victory and lacking peace. And I think this is a very, very important time in the church, not just globally, but in America, to be centered correctly, because if you're not centered correctly, you're going to lean either licentiously or legalistically, and you're going to see that all over Christianity. Are there going to be legalistic churches or licentious churches because they're not centered upon the new covenant? And so it's going back to the foundation again. We always have to look at our foundation.
Speaking recently in the eclectic Alabama area, that was Nick Cassidy. You can find out more information about the church by going to corkchurch.com. Well, finally, on this edition of the Intersection Podcast, it's Gary LeBlanc, president and founder of Mercy Chefs. In our conversation, he talked about not only the background of the organization, providing high-quality food in instances of disaster, but he also provided observations of his organization's activities in Louisiana to victims of flooding there. From that conversation, this is Gary LeBlanc.
We all know that something amazing happens over a shared meal.
Mm-hmm.
We do it as family. We do it as friends. We do it at the holidays. There is a communion that happens over a shared meal. And for us to be able to go into an area that's been devastated, whether it's an earthquake or a hurricane or a tornado or a flood or a fire, and provide a high quality meal and share that with a person that's lost everything, it isn't going to fix things for them, but it can restore a sense of normalcy or provide a glimmer of hope to bring a family back together around the table to share a meal, or to share a meal with people in your community or in your church. It's so important, I think, to letting folks know that there is a path back to gaining their lives.
Just recently returning to your home state to minister to those who have lost so much in the Louisiana flooding. And this is a topic we want to keep in the hearts and minds of our listeners. This is a tremendous disaster area in the Baton Rouge area, as well as other parts of the state of Louisiana. It is something that has taken people away from their homes. There's been significant damage for people's homes, for their properties, their livelihood. And so here you go into this situation. Gary, what are some of the things that Mercy Chefs began to do as you really observed what was taking place there in Louisiana?
Well, we were able to come in with a chef team and two of our mobile kitchens, and we were preparing 10,000 meals daily. And those were going out through a Bethany Church's system. They had rallied their church with a distribution system. And our food, besides being served there at the church and in that immediate neighborhood, was going out to 12 or 14 different locations. It was going out to shelters. It was going out to other churches in the affected neighborhoods. It was going out to community centers, police stations, fire stations, even to some of the hotels and motels that had large populations of folks that had been flooded out their homes. And it was just providing that meal for all those people in those circumstances.
Well, let's talk about your observations as you were there on the ground in Baton Rouge and the surrounding areas. I understand that obviously you've worked in Katrina. Compare these two disaster events.
Well, Katrina was obviously a lot worse because it was a much larger area and it was accompanied by wind. So you had that part of it, but the flooding part of it was just as bad. The neighborhoods and just the whole, you know, half of Baton Rouge was underwater. And, you know, you look at big disasters like that and it's so easy to focus on the disaster. But that disaster is in Baton Rouge, it was 200,000 people. Each one of those people were dealing with a disaster. I mean, the folks that are listening to the show right now, whether they're in their car or in their home or in their office, I mean, look around the room or look around the car and imagine 4 feet of water. It destroys everything. Just everything you see is gone or ruined. And that's 200,000 of those little disasters happen. It's not a big flood. It's that number of people that have each lost everything.
Well, with this sort of devastation, what were some of the biggest challenges to you as far as getting the food to the people?
Well, you saw the Cajun Navy on TV. I mean, we were sending meals out by boat for the first 5 days we were there. And we were there before most of the other organizations were able to get the wheels turning. You know, it takes bigger organizations 3, 4, 5 days to be able to respond. We're still quick and nimble, and it's our mission to be there immediately.
Gary LeBlanc here on The Intersection. The ministry's website is mercychefs.com. Well, we are nearing the end of this edition of The Intersection podcast. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. There you'll find a link to the download center marked Meeting House On Demand, through which you can listen to, download, or share full conversations with recent guests featured on The Intersection podcast. Also, through that site, you can get subscribed to The Intersection. Also, two blogs are accessible. Plus, you can follow me on Twitter and access the Meeting House Facebook page. You can get connected to video content as well. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. Thanks for joining me for this edition of The Intersection. I'm Bob Crittenden.